Devil's Ball, the podcast where we talk about horror and genre films in a positive and constructive manner. I'm Samuel Newman. With me, as always, is my co-host, Nathaniel Johnson. How are you doing tonight, man?
Doing okay. Doing
Good
okay.
to go.
I'm getting a little stoned. So,
Oh, all right. That's good. I've got a
yeah.
cough that hasn't gone away since last week. So if you
Oh.
hear it recording, my apologies. I'm gonna try to mute myself when it happens, but it could
Okay.
happen. We got a lot of guests this week. We have my wife Jen returning.
Greetings.
Hello. We've got Terry returning. Terry with
Yes,
us.
I am here. Yes.
Hello. And
Hello.
we've got Paul Stedman returning.
Yes, I just want to thank you guys, and also I'm so worried about the vampire problem in San Dimas. I think
Right. San Dimas.
it's not San Dimas, right?
No, it's Santa Cruz. Santa Clarita,
Santa
Zion. Yeah.
Clarita.
Well, yeah, in the Midwest we got problems too, so it's not really vampires yet, but
Right.
it might become that.
We're continuing on our vampire month with the Lost Boys, if you haven't already sussed that out from our weird jokes.
Yeah. And then last, which we actually said last episode, we were cutting. So it's back.
Right.
So
We're back. It's back.
we're doing it live.
We're doing fine. Do you want to go ahead and do the vitals while I
Sure.
come?
Sure. So The Lost Boys was made in 1987. It's directed by the late, great Joel Schumacher. Writing credits for Jan Fisher and James Jeremias, who were also wrote the story. And then it looks like a rewrite by Jeffrey Boehm. Our main cast of Jason Patrick, Corey Haim, Diane Weist, Bernard Hughes, Kiefer Sutherland, Jamie Gertz, Corey Feldman, Jameson Newlander, and Alex Winter are there. Alex Winter actually wasn't, I don't think, a huge star at the time, but he's since well known for other things. Although I think he did make, did he make Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure before this? I don't
I
think
think
he
so. I
did.
believe so. So he was going by Alexander.
He was going by Alexander Winter at the time, yeah. And then there is actually a cameo by Kelly Jo Minter, who
I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah.
who was in a few great horror films. Sam and I talked about her in a little bit in People Under the Stairs.
Right.
However, he was not on the episode. We talked about Nightmare 5, so we haven't talked about her in Nightmare 5. But that's the main cast of The Lost Boys. Where do we begin?
I'm just gonna pop in. This was the first time I've ever seen it.
Oh, yeah.
I think we mentioned. I know in conversation we've talked about. Sometimes you just get like these holes in genre
Right.
where like you watch 17 films, but the 18th you miss. So this is the one that I had not seen. Again, while it is definitely one of the better 80s movies I have ever seen, this one is great. Maybe not Roadhouse great, but still really great. There is so much to talk about, so much I loved for various reasons that would probably not have applied at the 80s because I would have been much smaller.
Right. Yeah, I thought you weren't going to care for this one, actually. I thought it was going to just like go right past you.
I like I said, I enjoy a good vampire movie. I was delightfully surprised with what they did with vampire tropes and kind of just messing them around a little bit. At the beginning, I was handling it like they don't know them because they're just like leaving out big pieces
Right.
that like the first thing I would say, like the when he was drinking the blood, which he thought was wine, which means he's a loser in two ways. He does not know what blood tastes like, and he does not know what wine tastes like. So
It was
that's,
the 80s. You might only be familiar with wine
yeah,
spritzers,
it wasn't Bartles
you
and Jane,
know.
so
Yeah. Well, it's just
he
like
wasn't
some
alone.
Boone's Farm. It's like, I don't know. This tastes like garbage anyways.
I think this is
Right.
probably the most dynamic of a conversation that you guys may have ever had because, you have two people who have seen it that might be on one side of an opinion, two people that are probably on another side of an opinion and somebody who came in completely cold that's never seen.
So my question to you is, you said you like a good vampire movie. With that being said, like, what are a few that you, that are your favorites? Cause I think that might be a good
I was in an interview with the vampire last week. So, you know, if you haven't heard it, go listen to it. It was pretty good.
Yeah, I did listen to that. That was really good conversation. Actually, I listened to the discussion that you guys had about The Hunger as well. So, So I'm really excited to talk about this.
I like that Terry said he's a better friend than I am. So I do. Yeah, that's fine.
Terry 1, Paul 0.
Yeah, as you go, that's fair. That makes sense. So yes, no, but like So I mean, other films,
like, you know, that like, you know. I've seen and read enough where I could get, like, you know, the tropes and how this works. And that's why, like I was saying, like, he was a loser twice. And then I kept saying to Rich, I'm like, he hasn't bled out. He's not a real vampire. They didn't bleed him out. What are they doing? They're stupid. And then, like, later they're like, oh, he's a half vampire. I'm like, oh, well, at least they came back. At least they circled back to that.
Right.
I appreciate that. And every time I thought they left something out, they did come and circle back to it. So I was appreciative of the time that they took, at least on affirming the tropes that they were planning on using. So that was nice. I liked that a lot. Characterization wasn't wildly successful. I don't think they don't need to be. Everybody just needed to be like one kind of thing, and they were, so that was fine. It drove the plot. That's all it needed. I would, and I don't know if this is a separate part of this conversation, but I think we need to address the Corey situation.
Which one?
Both. Yeah. It's both.
A real Corey problem here.
Yeah.
Movie's lousy with Corey's.
Yeah. It was riddled with Corey.
Yeah.
Rich, I know that you were saying that you had a problem with Corey Haim.
I've never understood the appeal of Corey Haim. I have obviously was not a teenage girl in the 80s, so I,
you know, well, give time, it might happen, you never know.
Right,
retroactively, he's going to,
right? But like,
you're like, I want to retire and become a teenage girl in the 80s, that's my retirement,
right? Period.
Yes,
I'm more of a Feldon guy, you know, but
which is fraught with its own peril,
yes, it's not a. Neither of them are good choices in retrospect.
So now you say the thing about the Corey Haim thing. Mm-hmm. Now, do you really feel like that was the grab for teenage girls to go see this film?
No, I think Jason Patrick was the
heartthrob.
But getting both Coreys, though, come on,
is our first film together too.
Yeah, this is when it started. Yeah,
but I'm saying, like, just they both were also having their moments. So
right.
Bringing them together, you know, like
they're all teen bop stars, you know, but like, I never quite got it. Cause like Corey Haim just always comes off as dorky to me. And maybe that's what the kids liked in the '80s. I don't know.
See, my exposure to Corey Haim was actually Silver Bullet.
If Gary Busey would played the grandfather, it would not have been age appropriate. That would have been a completely different film, and I loved it anyway. Yes.
So I know he's had his problems as an actor, maybe have not taken on the best roles for his career in it. But you know, I think, you know, taking off from Silver Bullet was a hell of a role to take on. Like, mm-hmm. I love that story in the beginning, and then just the film is. I love that. That's one of my favorite werewolf films of all time. Probably one of my favorite horror films of all time. I think that might be because of my exposure to it. I was very young when I saw that. But right. Yeah, I think it's an awesome film.
I mean, for the Corey thing, like, we'll make the joke that we've seen some of his, was it Me, Myself, and I, the video we put out about himself. And you can just tell, he's one of those guys that, like, he was so popular and made so much money that no one was around to tell him, like, dude, you're a kid, pump the brakes a little bit. With this, I will say that for the most part, I think he understood the assignment, because I think the way they wrote him was to be dorky and kind of like, he was the fish out of water, right? Like him and his brother, like, you know, his brother's like, I'm just waiting to fall into a biker gang. Like he was just waiting for that for like, I like that. There's the bit later on with, was it Jason Patrick? Is that the, cause I always want to I don't know why I get him and, whatever. Anyway, there's another guy I get him confused with where it's like, I like that the boardwalk lets you, like, this is California where it's really not like super cold. I'm just going to sell you a leather jacket on the boardwalk. There's just,
you know, that was what I said. I'm like, it's 90 degrees. What are you thinking?
Yeah. But I like, he's walking around and he's looking at the ear piercing station. And what was it? The one girl's like, that's a scam. I could pierce your ear for free. And then they never go back to it. But then later on, you see him with the ear piercing.
Right.
I'll push back on the leather jacket thing. I own a motorcycle. Leather jacket is critical for riding a motorcycle.
Sure. So, but also, like,
he has a motorcycle in. Yeah, I have.
Okay. Well, I just, you know, also.
He's right.
I worked at a motorcycle shop where, like, they sold this stuff.
Fine. You and your knowledge and whatever. Fine. I accept that. No, but
he lived a whole life before he came to this city where they would have, I'm pretty sure in Phoenix, Arizona, they wouldn't have sold motorcycle equipment.
Yeah.
Right? Like, they wouldn't have sold gear for that.
Arizona, it's like there's probably not as many people on the road. Like when you go out to California,
it's one of the bigger population centers in Arizona. Even then, it isn't like it wasn't like there's three houses in a saloon. It wasn't like, you know, you see people be rolling through like, oh, Phoenix is gonna take off one day, you know.
Anyways, I'm just saying that there's a reason that he could be buying a leather jacket.
Sure, okay. I like that it's available. Well,
he was also caressing it like he had just birthed a child. So
credit to the film, though. I was watching this with headphones on, and the ADR in this, every time he was on screen with that leather jacket, it should get an acting credit. The leather jacket made so much noise.
I
respect that because leather jacket, like any, like weak.
The one thing that doesn't track though is they put it out there as like they don't have a pot to piss in when they move to grandpa's house. Mm-hmm. And then he buys a leather jacket.
Yeah.
So I'm like, wait a minute, where did this money come from suddenly?
Yeah. That's fair. But I'm saying,
like when he's asking about a job, like, is there any jobs around here? Nothing
with
legal.
Him trying to fit in and then also having hots for Jamie Gertz, you know, fair enough. Mm-hmm. Whatever. Credit to that. But like, I think having the Corey, the young, like the other Corey, Haim, be like, you know, like he thinks he knows what's cool. And like with him, when he goes into the comic shop with the Frog Brothers and kind of like he does his whole like my nerd dick's bigger than your nerd dick. Right. Like I was watching that. I was thinking, I was like, that's kind of like that's internet culture now where it's like, but actually
I asked Rich, I'm like, is that how boys make friends?
And I'm like, yes, it pretty much is.
Sometimes. Yeah.
And sometimes
that's how Paul and I were friends.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nerd dicked.
Yeah. We were just like, hey, I know more than you. And he's like, I know more than you. I'm like, we're going to have to kiss at some point.
And I'm going to tell you, I had a problem with that scene because my nerd dick even bigger. And he's complaining about the, you know, you can't put issue number 60 in with the 100s. Lori Lamaris hasn't been introduced yet. And I went, oh, excuse me.
Numerical order.
Excuse me. Lori Lamaris was a Superboy character. One, he dated her when he was a teenager. But Crisis on Infinite Earths came out 4 years before this movie. And Lori Lamaris, Superboy, never existed. Post crisis, so you can't put that issue in anywhere because Lori Lamaris does not exist. So Corey Haim, wherever you are, in whatever afterlife you're in, mic drop, boom.
My nerd dick just rolled up inside myself there. I'm sorry.
That's just like one of the funny things about some of the Wikipedia information that you find. Donner and Schumacher were like big fans of like comic books and that. And it's just like they were trying to like influence, like, yeah, he's a big comic book nerd. Here's all this information. It's like, yeah, nerd out. Like they're going to like kind of like make the character after ourselves. And it's like, here we go.
Yeah.
Like
he was able to like kind of like front, and then the Frog Brothers who work at a comic shop because their parents run it, they're like, okay, maybe that's okay. Like I thought that was okay. It was you know, whatever. It is what
it is. One of my favorite scenes in the movie, just because it's just so much fun to watch them.
I would just tell you too that to make references about comic books and not really be part of the club at a comic shop is not really the best thing to do. I made a joke while I was at our local comic shop.
Carol, oh yeah. No, they'll tell you.
It literally was like dead silence in the room.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Unless you're going to make if you're going to make a reference joke to comic books, you have to know your stuff or they will just actually, they won't get the joke. They will instead try to.
Well, I made a horror film reference to this movie. And then like the guy's like, the guy who actually owns the shop is like, was that a Lost Boys reference? I was like, yeah. And he just walked out of the store.
Yeah, walked away. Nice.
Like, all right.
Tough crowd.
He actually he fired Terry on the spot, and Terry didn't work there. It was really weird.
It's like, get your shit and leave.
No, but yeah,
like,
you're banned. Yeah, like, so we don't allow Lost Boy jokes here.
We're deleting your file.
So speaking to like Samuel talking about like, you know, the Corey problem, I think he was okay here. I also, upon this rewatch, Corey Feldman's performance actually was a lot more enjoyable to me, realizing that he's a kid trying to be like Charles Bronson.
Yeah,
you know, like, it's, yeah, everyone's like, "Oh, that voice is a choice." It's like it is, right. Like, and yeah, it's like, yeah, and it's actually like people might say like he's like, you know, like overacting, but I'm like, he's a kid, like he's trying to be the tough guy. It's right. For was it Truth, Justice, and the American Way, and so of course he's going to try to emulate that kind
that
of.
That was his direction. Yeah, like Joel Schumacher told him like, look, yeah, I worked with you before. I need you to be a different character now. So go get yourself a couple of Rambo films and go get yourself a couple of Chuck Norris films and take some notes, because I need you to be more badass.
Yeah.
Fronting, because we can talk about this as we get into it, where how both the Frog Brothers are like eager. Like they're the guys that are like the state militia. Like, you know, if the Civil War happened today, we'd be all about it. And both times they're actually like confronted with things going on. They both become like Abbott and Costello.
They fall through a little bit.
Just run away. Like they freak out. Like, you know, and it's like, it's amazing how like, as much as they're all about it, the moment
I collapse in the face of the enemy.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, sorry, and it's a little scatterbrained, but yeah, I think, I don't know, one of the strengths for me is actually both Corey's in this, because I think they both understood the movie they were in. Like, that's right. My opinion. Sorry. And Sam, you can tell me I'm wrong. And
I think I like Corey Haim's performance in this movie. I think he's right on for the role. But it's like, I just in general, like I never understood the, you know, the appeal of
the appeal. Corey Haim that's fair.
As a teen heartthrob.
I'm not sure I understood the appeal of either Corey, but yeah, I mean, like they sure were there. I mean,
well, at least
like,
you know, Corey Feldman, you know, could kill Michael Myers, Jason Voorhees whenever he wanted to, you know.
Yeah.
Or maybe just the once,
right?
Twice, like.
Well, he was also in was it the Goonies before this, so it's like, you know,
and that's why he was brought on by Schumacher. So.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, that's that was the big. Gremlins and Goonies were the two movies that like made his career, Feldman. Like, you know, he passed on doing like a sequel to Friday the 13th to go do Gremlins, and then Gremlins he blew up, and then he was like, you know, I'm gonna do Goonies with, you know, Donner and Spielberg.
Yeah. And I'm actually surprised, because there was a bit of like turmoil between Feldman and Schumacher and the production. So like he was getting high a lot during this filming and day he couldn't stay awake and on set. So Schumacher actually fired him too.
Fair enough. But also like they were allowed, but grandpa was allowed to grow weed outside his house. So I don't know how we feel about that.
Well, cocaine and smoking a little weed here and there, it's a little different, you know, but
also credit to Feldman too. He actually agreed to make a cameo on Friday Five, right? Cause they actually shot
They did it at his house, actually.
They shot with a rain machine in his backyard for a couple hours. Yeah, to get the intro to Five. Yeah.
No, but you want to talk about like child stars that were rode hard and put away wet, like that poor guy. Like, I mean, you know, like
he's still around. He's a mess now. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He's been even in the extras of the DVD and the Blu-ray that came out for Lost Boys, he said this is one of the hardest films that he ever had to film because of all the shit that was going on in his life at that time.
And he was how old at this point? What, like 15, 16, maybe?
If that, maybe, yeah.
Right.
Like maybe, like I guess closer to 16.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. That's, we got to be realistic about that. Right. But like that, cause I don't know, child stars, easy to exploit.
He seems to be
in our support system. I mean, it's better now. Better-ish.
All the interviews that I saw, like he was the only one that had any kind of like problems with the production and that, but it wasn't even the production. It was all the things that were going on in his life.
Right.
Well, he could just go take a nap with Michael Jackson. It'll be fine. You know, whatever.
you're over here advocating to take it easy on him, and then you go there.
No, I'm saying it happened. Whatever. Anyway, just whatever. What I'm saying is, like, we need to understand that, like, shit was sideways, but, like, he did live a life that has had a lot of messed up things. So,
sure. Yeah.
No, that's how I'm couching it. Please don't cancel me. Whatever. It's fine.
No, you're right. I mean, yeah, he was going through a lot. I mean, I think we're actually in agreement that he wasn't bad in it, though.
No.
Like, yeah. So, I mean, but yeah, I mean, overall, as far as the appeal of the Corys, I think I'm with Sam. I don't know why they were a thing, but they were, and they're in this, and I think that they're okay. I would argue Haim doesn't do it for me in this movie, but my kind of problem with the movie is sort of his character. Right, so, I think the
script writes him younger than he is. Yes. That's the way I kind of feel like, and so like
there's some of that
they
too.
Did that part of it.
Yeah, it's like, oh, yeah. you're gonna take a big bubble bath, and like, you know, do like the mohawk with your hair and listen to songs from like 30. It's just a weird framing.
He seems to be the most jaded for like for what the 80s had to offer as far as like. Like he has one shirt that on it says like "Born to Shop."
Born to Shop.
Yeah, I was like.
But also, did you notice that he had like what was the poster in the background of his room? It was like
Rob Lowe.
Rob Lowe.
Yeah.
Well, he had Rob Lowe, but then he also had what's her name from Pretty in Pink?
Molly Ringwald. Ringwald.
Yeah, he had a Molly Ringwald.
And also, the world's largest wristwatch that was hanging up on the wall. If you guys,
my aunt had one of those.
Oh, okay.
So.
I'm sorry. I did. So you're,
that was a thing okay. that you could buy those from Spencer's.
No, I'm aware. but no, it just, if there's anything that I think in terms of the actors and the characters that were given short shrift was every vampire that wasn't Kiefer Sutherland.
And even right. Kiefer isn't exactly given that much to do,
but when that's fair.
He does a lot with what he has. Jesus and Christ. That is definitely one of the positive things I have about Lost Boys is Kiefer actually is doing some pretty subtle work on occasion. But
I think he does a lot of heavy lifting in this.
He's
as far
doing,
as
like, yeah. There are a lot of sequences that are working because he's just bringing that energy. But yeah, for sure. And that's kind of my main issue with Lost Boys is there's two movies happening in Lost Boys. One of them sucks and one of them is good. And the one that sucks is the My Brother is a Vampire kids movie for the Disney Channel that's happening. And then there is like Interview with the Vampire meets Rocky kind of going on over here. Not Rocky, Rocky IV happening over on the, you know, on the other side. That movie's interesting. I'm like, give me more of the like Jason Patrick falling into the bad crowd. Right. And that bad crowd is vampires, and he and Kiefer kind of making eyes at each other where we both hate each other, but we also want to have sex. Like, make that movie. Then there is, like, you know, Help, My Brother is a Vampire, coming soon on the Disney Channel, in which they're pouring cold water in some guy's groin and doing Abbott and Costello. It feels too young, and I think this was what I think Terry was saying, or Paul and Terry both were saying about Haim being cast almost seemingly to play much younger than he was, because there is a very childish, dumb movie going on half of this film. And it's very dumb. And the thing is, the problem is, I think Schumacher thought it was very funny, but it feels targeted at an audience that is entirely different than the audience that the film is actually targeted at, if that makes sense.
Well, it does. I think originally they were going for a younger movie. They wanted it to be like, you know, Goonies with vampires.
Okay,
that was the initial thought. Yeah,
yeah. And Joel Schumacher came on and he said, "No, we're gonna make them, you know, teenagers. Mm-hmm. You know, that'll sell better. It'll be cooler."
Right.
So when they did the rewrite, there's still those vestiges of this like younger kids movie going on.
I didn't know there was literally a reason for that. Okay. Yeah. It doesn't work for me. I still stand by the criticism, but yeah.
You see is what you see. It's fair enough. Yeah. Like Terry,
it's trying to do like two coming of age stories at once, and it kind of doesn't give either of them the time it needs to flower.
And they collide. Right. Like they are holding each other back. Like they're both like they're in the water and one of them is drowning the other. Like it's, you know, trying to get out.
There was a lot of what was it? A lot of cooks in the kitchen for this. You could kind of get that vibe.
Yeah.
Right. I'd also argue, and I didn't even think about this, but like how Big Trouble in Little China went through so many different iterations before we got what we got. Right. Mm-hmm. And as much as I love that film, you could tell that where it started or where it ended up at, it's like you'd be like, it's like a game of telephone, right? So I'm going to guess like the Lost Boys is an idea. It's not the same thing as what we got. That's fine. Jen, I'm going to put it to you because you're very cynical. Did you, like, I watching this again, the sequence involving was Jason Patrick, like learning he could fly and it was outside the window. The telephone sequence. I think that's funny how like we get Corey Haim calling his mom. And then all of a sudden, the only thing it's holding Jason Patrick back is that phone. And he's like, don't listen to him. I love how we see his feet drift into the frame. So Jen, I know
it's definitely from one of the movies.
Right. No, I know that for you, like if it doesn't smell that doesn't pass the smell test, you're like, nah, I'm good. Like very slapsticky, but I don't know if you thought that was funny or not. I think it was actually a pretty fun sequence.
I'm very touch and go with slapstick in general. But I mean, like I said, for the kid portion of this movie, it was cute and kind of funny. And then you had like both of the siblings shouting into the phone about whether or not something bad is going on, which if you grew up with siblings, you absolutely had that conversation.
Oh yeah. That part is real. Yeah.
That felt legitimate.
We're all part of a generation of actually having a landline that could pick up the phone.
Yeah. And we all are of the generation that mom would call from work because we were all probably, I'm guessing we were all pretty much latchkey kids for most part.
She's on a date at that point.
But that's the thing is mom will call and be like, how is everything? And the little brother would be like, this literally used to happen. My brother would be like, he's being mean. He's gonna smash stuff. And then I'm like, mom, don't you listen to a word he says. I pick up the other phone and like my mother's like, what the hell is going on? And I'm like, you tell your little bastard to shut up. Like that's
talking
real.
Shit about Lost Boys.
It's like it's literally that it's real.
When you come home, that is actually threw the milk on the floor, not me. Like
why would I clean it up?
Yeah, exactly. Why would I clean it up? He threw it, dropped it on the floor. Yeah.
So I think that felt
very lifelike.
Yeah. It's just because it felt like it was taking the piss out of like Salem's Lot a little bit with the whole like, you know.
Yes,
like,
exactly.
Like it's a little bit. I thought I was taking that. And I'm not saying that might be a direct reference, but it kind of felt like that. We see the shoes coming in the frame and everything going on there. I thought that was okay.
Stuck for like a minute, like on like the ceiling or whatever. I'm like, okay, this looks a little weird.
That reference would be pretty recent at that point too, because what was it? Salem's Lot was 1981.
Yeah, it's
somewhere around
that's
there.
Fair. But like
that or 79. Yeah.
I think 79.
Oh, 79.
Like,
yeah.
With him like sleeping and like floating towards the ceiling and him waking up is like, I wonder if a younger Vince Gilligan is like, you know what? I'm going to use this in Breaking Bad at one point where Jesse Pinkman gets high as fuck. You know, like I think that, you know, there are some interesting choices to tell stories here. And credit to Schumacher and the cinematographer. I have his name up here. One second. It is, Michael Chapman. There are some really interesting dynamic shots going on here. There are times where this film punches above its weight and what it's showing. And I kind of dig it. Like I I'm overpowering the conversation. Sorry, everybody. This is what I do. I apologize. There's something about this era of like 80s filmmaking with the way these films have this kind of like the darks are dark. Like this is the movies that this is film to me. Right. This film, I understand that like I was watching, I own the Blu-ray, but I was like, well, that's downstairs. I guess I could just steal it. So anyway, sorry, I have admitted to pirating a film that I already own. So did I really pirate it? No. Whatever. The Blu-ray skin of this is gorgeous. This film has no reason looking as good as it does. And something about that all comes together for me. And some of the shot choices and some of the, like the carousel sequence at the beginning of the film looks really cool. The sequence with them with the dirt bikes.
The opening sequence with the helicopter shots.
Yes.
Right.
Like coming down over the amusement park in it is phenomenal.
Well, because now everything, it's easy to be like, we're just going to use a drone, right? Everything, every production that's worth $15 has one big overarching drone shot where it's like, yeah, I've seen The Shining, like whatever. Like I just calm down, right? Whatever. That's the go-to shot now. Using a helicopter, way more expensive, and you're using a film camera. That's a challenge.
But you know, it tracks throughout the rest of the film of why those shots are the way that they are now. Like it's not just like, oh yeah, let's give it like an overarching like view of the city or whatever.
Yeah.
it works towards the rest of the storytelling.
Schumacher realized that if you show vampires flying from that distance, it's going to look stupid as shit.
Yep.
And so because even at the end, when we get the big confrontation in the, like at the house, every time you see them all moving towards each other, it's super fast.
And it's reaction. It's all reaction.
There's a couple stuff. Times where you see like a second of them flying around because they knew that if they showed them all doing this, it was dumb.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, anyway, so I think they made it a point to be like, okay, what can't we show? Can we do this? Because there's the bit too. Also, there's that big shot of the camera going in towards the alcove of the Fallen Hotel, which we can talk about the production design. That set is amazing.
Yeah.
And how, like, originally you see them moving into there and doing the whole thing where it's like, we're going into this like hole or whatever. And then at the end of the movie, they do the reverse of it. I don't know if you guys noticed, it goes the exact opposite.
The waves.
And you see the waves moving backwards as they're moving away from the place. I'm like, God bless you, Joel Schumacher, that you realize that people in the theater don't have the ability to rewind a film and they would not even notice that. So anyway, this film, they're shitting and it's like, it just, I don't know, man. It's like, there's a lot of thought and care put into actually how the story is told that I think is lost sometimes now. And I'll shut up.
Schumacher's a very underrated director when it comes to, I think, his, you know, visual style. You know, being a music video director, you know, mm-hmm. you have to be able to imprint stuff really fast and on budget and on time. And I think, you know, something that he's taken away from that is,
you know, you want to talk about on time. This was done in 3 weeks.
What? Wow. Yeah. The whole film?
The whole film was shot in 3 weeks.
Holy shit. Yeah.
No reason Corey Feldman was trying to get high and run through things. Right. Oh my God, like that's a...
Yeah, it's breakneck speed when it comes to productions. I'm like, yeah.
Can you even order leather jackets that fast?
Joel Schumacher, like, he actually got physical with one of the actors too. He slapped one of the actors and pushed him off set.
It better not have been Alice Winters.
I hope it was this little child. I hope it was a small child. Yeah.
Oh no, it was the blonde vampire, the long haired blonde vampire.
Oh, okay.
So, but yeah, he got physical. Like, so this guy was at his wit's end at certain times too. It's like no reason to be slapping anybody. Like,
no,
it's like no one should be doing that. But like, he was really pushing himself to a point where it's like he's overextending himself with not just the actors. And not just the production, but like all the other facets of all the other things, like, you know, like reworking the makeup and reworking the prosthetics and like figuring out like how to get shots that really, like, how can you extend yourself that much further so you can control everything? Like micromanagement at that scale is it's insane.
The pre-production on that must have been extensive and solid for him to do it in 3 weeks. Cause like that Fallen Hotel set, I'm going to also like, there's this kind of like old Hollywood like vibe to this, right? Where it's like you get the coastline, you get the boardwalk, and you get this hotel. And mm-hmm. I like that they tied in, what was it, that like 1910 San Francisco earthquake, how everything's collapsed, whatever. It's a cool looking set. And it makes sense because it's like, that's the thing that happened. There's these forgotten relics, and also they're ageless. So why not go to a place that, like, they can't die. So why not hang out in a hotel that is for the damned? That's a cool set. It's a really cool set. And it must have been a lot of fun to be a production designer to try to design like a golden age Hollywood hotel.
Yeah. Set dressing is all over the place in this film.
Also, even Grandpa's house. How many animals do you think died to get stuffed in that film?
All of them.
Oh, man. I bought out a lot of thrift stores.
The running joke of the taxidermy was actually pretty funny because you get the two, and then there's that joke of whenever Corey Haim opens.
He wakes up.
He freaks out because the owl, but he goes to put it in the closet, and there's like now 15 more other things.
Yeah. Dude, I would have loved that. Like, I would have.
I like the running gag of Grandpa going to get laid.
Put some more Windex on there, Grandpa.
Right.
That feel is so fresh.
I always, just for whatever reason, I know that the actor's name is Barnard Hughes. I just want to be like, is that Jason Robards? I always want to, because he was in, what was it, Dream a Little Dream with Corey Feldman? God. Yeah. Right?
That movie sucks.
What?
That
movie's fucking great.
No.
Break it out. Delicious Division. Yes.
No. Yuck.
That was awesome.
No, License to Drive. Good film. All like right, the Corys. So. Right.
So I know I'm talking too much. Nathaniel, like you have, and I know Samuel, I know that I think you like this, but I think you guys are more aligned about how you feel about it. So well,
I don't dislike it. It's like, I never got the cult of this movie. You know, the people who are like, you know, this is my favorite movie ever. And like, this is, you know, like, I'm not down on the movie. I like the movie. But
when would you say that the first time you saw this film was there, Sam?
I was like probably like 15.
Okay, so you were still at an age that, all right, like
you got done taking a bath and making a mohawk with your
right, home. Yeah,
yeah, ain't got no home. one of my best friends hates this film, with a burning passion, hates this film. And I'm like, I just don't get it. Like, is it just like an adult thing? Because it got panned by a lot of adults, like the critics when it came out. So I'm like, is it an adult thing versus like people that were younger that saw it and maybe could appreciate it for what it was?
Well, if you think about it in like the terms of like what your run of the mill film reviewer would say about it at the time that it was reviewed, I mean, you're looking at like, okay, overarching character development. Well, there's not a ton.
Right.
Your female protagonist that isn't the mom is named Star. Her features include she wears bohemian skirts and has three lines that forward the plot.
Right.
Like, but that's like a big deal. And, you know, there's not really anyone else female involved that would have much to say about anything going on in this movie. You've got a bunch of child actors doing child actor things. So, I mean, there's, you know, which isn't exactly, you know, grip a Hollywood film reviewer. So, I mean, genre films don't get the kind of respect and attention, at least at this time, that, you know, run.
That's for damn sure.
No, I get your point about like the cult of the film. Like I think that's where, for me, that's where I get some pushback. Like not pushback's not the right word. Where there's things where like I watch stuff just like we're like, you know what, it's okay. And then people are like, what? Like it's just there's right. Certain things that I'm like, it's okay. This isn't a personality trait for me. Like this isn't like I don't know. I always make the jokes like, you know, the show Friends or The Office isn't a personality trait. You know, like right. Just you can. It's or like Harry Potter's not a personality trait. This is me. I'm gonna
having children is not a personality trait.
what's the thing people say now? Catching strays. I'm just shooting strays out to everybody. I'm just like, I'm taking down franchises. I don't care. But there's just times where it's like people are just like, this is the greatest goddamn thing in the world. It's like, okay, fine, cool. You have that. I'm not saying that your love of I'm not gonna judge your love of something. So. I didn't realize that like there was like this big like and you're like in the things that you've encountered where it's like all the Lost Boys is like this revelation. It's not. It's a genre film. It's right. Supposed to put butts in the seats. It's supposed to be a crowd pleaser. If there was a midnight showing of this in the theater, I'd go because it's a lot of fun. That's kind of, you know what I mean. Like it's not doing anything more than that. However, what I'm saying is like it's competently made. And mm-hmm. like it's just like and it doesn't treat its audience as stupid, you know. Like, and I think sometimes some of genre horror is like, oh, we can just get away with this because people are just going to like the kills or the gore, right? Like, it's like no, like there's actually a little there. Like, credit to this film, there's a little bit going on under the hood, not a lot. You know, as much as Grandpa doesn't want to go to town in that nice car, like just start the engine, hear it roar, and turn it off. Maybe that's where we're at with this movie. I don't know, but like, there's at least enough. There's enough going on.
Right.
I was talking to Terry before we started recording. I was like, I think this and like Near Dark would be a good, like double feature. Cause right. Near Dark also has a black sense of humor, but it's a little bit more serious. Also I'd even argue like something like this and like, you know what, if you want to get like fucking stupid, like Bordello Blood, where it's like, that is completely garbage, but also a fun film. Just ignore Dennis Miller. You know,
Ben, probably Corey Feldman, actually. Yeah,
that's right. I forgot. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, there you go. There's your Corey connection, which I know that's your goal for every episode is to have
the Corey connection. We are not planning to discuss Bordello Blood anytime soon. So
good.
Okay, so what you're saying next week? to do another vampire film, I'll be down. Also, another film that involves squirt guns full of holy water.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that's deliberate, but yes.
In the second film that I knew from around that time that used Ballroom Blitz as a montage song. So that and, you know, the vampire film we all know is Wayne's World.
Right.
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 That whole squirt guns full of holy water thing we were also discussing yesterday, as in, where do you get all of that holy water?
Right. Well,
did you like that sequence?
You have to go to like 1,000 churches to get that much. They sell that stuff in little vials like this for $20. Like, it is.
It could be like homeopathy.
I think the line of like theory is that like if you pour a little bit of the holy water into bath water, that somehow it turns it all holy.
Right.
I think that's what
they're children. Water into wine. I think that's
so terrible. But that does imply that the idea of blessing, water is like a virus or something, like it's an infection, because then it spreads out. Like
it's homeopathic is what it is. You've got the times bit that all of it is, right?
All you have to do is believe.
You just gotta have Harvey Keitel come in and bless it.
Right.
He'd be the first person I thought of.
Are you guys ever gonna cover From Dusk Till Dawn? Because I'll be on for that in a second.
I thought they
already did.
Yeah, they did.
Oh, okay. I'm a bad person. I apologize.
First vampire song.
He's not one of the only 20.
Anyway. Yeah, we did that randomly, But yeah.
You wanna do it again? I'm kidding. No, we won't do it again. Did you want to cover Texas Blood Money or whatever the Hangman's Daughter or whatever the other two films are?
Actually, I like Hangman's Daughter. Actually, I think that one's pretty good. But yeah,
I just really want to talk about Selma Hayek's feet. If we could just have a conversation about
that. You can do that anytime.
That's a different podcast, man. You got to get on his podcast.
Yeah.
He's got a podcast, actually.
Yeah. Anyway, so Nathaniel, like, where are your big problems with the film? Because I know, not big problems, but you're not as big as a fan as other people.
That is true. Yeah.
Completely valid, so please.
Yeah. Watching it last night, I find every time I watch Lost, but because you're right, there are a lot of conversations out there where people are like, how do you not like The Lost Boys? Like, how is that even possible? And I'm like, well, pretty easily. In fact, I kind of fell into it. It didn't actually take a lot of effort. Like I said earlier, my biggest problem with it is that tonal divide, that I think is like there's one interesting movie going on, and then there's the dumb Disney Channel Nickelodeon movie going on, and they are literally dragging each other down. Even if they were contrasting, that might work, but I feel like they're fighting for time. Like I use the analogy of drowning, like both in the water. Right now, the film feels to me like the kids' movie is literally like pulling the other one down into the water. I'm gesturing with my arms, but nobody can see it. It feels like it's just kind of dragging it down. I think there is a weird disconnect happening with Haim. I don't think that's working. Even considering the caveats that we mentioned earlier, as far as Corey Haim performances go, I don't think this is among his best. The Frog Brothers, I am tempted to like, except for the fact that I know they grew up to be Trump supporters. And I'm like, these two kids are not, it's funny to me that you could get away with these archetypes. I think in 87, I don't think you could get away with it now, because they give off like, school shooter vibes, how gung ho they are about killing vampires. But the whole time I kept thinking like adding lines to Feldman that were basically like, the only good vamp is a dead vamp because they steal our jobs. Like, it just feels like that's the thing. And they're like, I'm going to go get a gun. But they grade on me. They always did. I don't think the bit's that funny. I think it would be if it was in its own movie, like its own kids movie, that bit might work. But I find, and it's up until the point, specifically, I think it's the Aerosmith Walk This Way murder scene at the party is the point where I'm like, well, wait a minute, this is coming out of left field now. you've been very, very restrained up until this point, and I see what they're doing. He's trying to signify a swap, but it kind of kills the movie dead. Any momentum it had built gets dropped, and now we're in kind of a different movie, and you have to reacclimate tonally. But then it still is, the other tone is still intruding because the Frog Brothers are still kind of going, you know, doing Three Stooges bits. And then I also find, like, one of the other problems I have with this film is Star. She has nothing to do.
Right.
She has no real agency. She just exists. And the thing is that if you made this movie in 2024, she wouldn't be there. It would just be gay.
Right.
Okay. Like, but this movie, the only reason Star seems to be there is to be the movie's beard. And it doesn't work, I think. I lose all sympathy for Jason Patrick the point when she comes to actually try to help him and he just starts kind of like being a dick to her. Yeah. And then, of course, that scene, which should be heartfelt and connective, features Corey Haim hiding under a blanket, whimpering lines at them in the middle of it.
You talk about the tonal shift. That is scene that's the dichotomy of the two halves you're talking about.
Yeah, and it hurts. It hurts to watch because I want to watch this interaction between Jason Patrick and Star. But then they keep cutting away to a very flamboyantly dressed Corey Haim, by the way, under a blanket, whimpering and yelling out lines that are basically expositional in the middle of a core conflict moment within your narrative.
It would have been better in that instance if he wasn't shouting everything.
Yeah.
What he's saying is actually, like, on the page is funny, but the way he plays it there is not good.
There's
a lot of shriek acting in this movie.
Yeah.
There is a lot of shriek acting, and that's one of the other things I have a problem with. It. I think that I actually do think that Jason Patrick, and here's where I'm going to shift into the positives, you know, because I sound like I totally hate the movie, but I don't.
It only took us 40 minutes, but yeah, continue, please.
Yeah, but I mean, I do, I think Jason Patrick's actually really good in this. I think he's a really compelling lead, to the point that, again, I'm like, why don't we ditch the younger brother and just make this movie about, you know, guy who is... You know, he's an interesting character. He has there's this nice divide of between him being a young man who's about to go out on his own and maybe is a little rebellious, but at the same time is loyal to his mother and effective his mother. Because you guys mentioned earlier, like, a line, he says, "Are any jobs around here?" I think he's asking for her.
Right.
You know, he's trying to find something for his mother. Like, he's taking on this other role. And his relationships with Diane Weiss, who's also wonderful in this movie, by the way.
It's reaffirmed too, because we get the line from Max. It says, "You're the man of the house." It's like,
yes.
So like, he is being looked at as the guy who's like kind of like becoming a little bit more of like, you know, somebody who is an enforced figure of like what's going on with the structure of the household.
Totally. Yeah. And I think he's doing a great job. I think he plays the conflict of turning into a vampire well. I think all of that stuff is interesting. And then, as I mentioned, Kiefer Sutherland is doing some really subtle work here and there. That's you would think was maybe you're reading into it until his death. And then they have that moment where he's actually grateful. You know, his face is one of peace, one of relief. But then you notice, if you go back and watch it, knowing how that ends, if you watch it again, he sheds a tear a lot.
Yes.
Like three or four times in the picture.
He says like you're dead meat or whatever, and after he, like, there's that conflict during the daytime, right?
At
their enclave, and then he looks and he's just like in agony, and you see that one tear. You're like, Jesus Christ, there's actually like depth going on here. Like,
it's,
like, he is as upset at this as that Christmas tree attacks that one point in that one video. I don't know if you guys have ever seen him drunk.
I have seen Kiefer, you're a cowboy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Terry, you've not seen the video. I'll show you later. He looks at a pine tree or a Christmas tree in a lobby. He's like, nah. And he just Jack Bowers the shit out of this place.
He's hanging out with some guy, with some friends, and he's obviously completely intoxicated. And one of them who's holding the camera says, Kiefer, you're a cowboy. And Kiefer just turns and sees a Christmas tree and dives on top of it like a jungle cat.
It's
yeah.
Like, it's
amazing. It's like the entire video is like 2 seconds long, and it's one of the funniest things ever made. It's also really sad when you consider how fucked up Kiefer was at the time.
Yeah, it's not Hasselhoff cheeseburger sad.
Yeah, not quite.
I don't think any one of us has to go on like this some kind of speech that Kiefer Sullivan is a great actor, but at this young of an age to take on such amazing roles, like really, I mean, like just think about like. It was like just that year that it was that this was released that he was casted. Stand By Me. I mean, him as the leader of the snakes, like, you know, it's like he was such a badass in that movie. It's like, and then just like his like career just went off, like
the sequence, whenever they first bring Jason Patrick to their, you know, their hotel, and they have the Chinese food bit where it's just him pushing. And just like just messing with him is so good. It's so really good.
And then he's a guy who doesn't walk away from a set, because he broke his wrist in the production of this too. He broke his wrist and he still was riding a motorcycle and everything. Right. You know, it's like,
well, I believe it. Yeah.
It's incredible because it's like they, you know, they're like, this guy is like balls deep. Like he is not messing around, you know?
Yeah. Oh yeah. He's definitely balls deep. No, he's very good. He's very good in this movie. He really is. But that's kind of what frustrates me, I think, a little bit, is that there is all this stuff going on with these other characters that is being shortchanged by the fact that I got to spend time with the Frog Brothers.
Like, I don't even think they were necessary to the plot. Like, I get it.
Some exposition, and then they were there for the conflict and to do some comic relief. Yeah.
I told Rich, I'm like, he could have found a book at a bookstore and was dusty. He could have opened it up, read it, and
like the Howling kind of scenario. Like,
yeah.
So, okay. So with that being said,
Master, perhaps.
Which comic book have you all read that you believe is the truth of what's going on in the world? You know, like
Spider-Man. Ghost Rider 2099.
Ghost Rider.
Days of Future Past.
Yeah, no,
yeah, that's probably closer to just, this reality.
Anything P-Car talking about Cleveland and being sad. That's what.
Well, no, I mean, if you want to talk about comic books, you think are reality. I mean, you got a whole thing going on right now about a bunch of people who apparently never heard of X-Men before, claiming it's anti-woke, you know, and people are sharing, like, you know.
Oh, Morph is non-binary? They mean the mutant in whatever shape?
Yeah, the shapeshifter, yeah.
You're like, I'm checking out now.
I am re-watching that cartoon right now just so I can get prepared for the new one that's coming out. Yeah.
Brief aside, the recent trailer for X-Men 97 is on Disney Plus. It's going to be a lot of fun, but people are doing like side by sides of the original series and the current one. And there's that stupid meme shot of Rogue with like the very
I've seen this one.
And then somebody posted an image from the trailer where it shows her like, you know, like it's just whatever. They're like never forget what you lost. I'm like, God,
what they took from us.
Yeah. It's like it's funny, but it's also not, because it's like, how would you stroke it off to a cartoon character? I don't know what's on there.
And even if you were, when you were a kid, that might be okay, but you probably shouldn't be mentioning that now.
Right.
You know,
those things just like, just calm down anyway. But yes.
Yeah. The meme went around originally of that one animation still of Rogue's butt in the original film. And it's huge. And I did see some guy being like, they took away
moment or the butt. Like, can you
the
please?
Butt? But yeah, then they say, but now there are people going like comparing it to the new one, with saying like, you know, they took away her butt, and that's like that's terrible because it's woke. You know,
it's so stupid. It's just like, calm down. Anyway, but But no, I'm just saying, like, if there's like a comic book, like, I feel like every person that has a Punisher sticker, sorry, every policeman has a Punisher sticker on the car, it's like, oh, you read the wrong comic, or you didn't read it at all. So I feel like this, with this one single comic that was like Vampires Everywhere or whatever it was called, it's like, why is this like the big, like, what if they would have handed him like a copy of like, I don't know, or what the Marvel comic, right? Like here,
deep gut.
Like, here you go, Forbush Man. Here, this is the reality. going on. Thank you for appreciating what I said, because no, Howard the Duck, here, read this book. This is reality going on.
Yeah, right? This is reality. Yeah. I get your point. Yeah, he could have handed him anything, like, you know, they could have handed him a Bible and it would have been like, you know,
yeah,
he would fall into bad habits there. But
can we also speak about
the Mormon Bible,
about Max head vampire? So clearly he's been around for a while, and somehow he thought that like the way to having sustainability was to have a video store on a boardwalk that has a very transient population.
Right.
Do you think Max, like, I mean, we get that he died at the end of this film, but we also know, I wish there was a sequel where he lived and like it was only like 10 years later where he's like, oh, I've been undead for a while. I completely misread the video market.
Right. He's now running the last Blockbuster.
Yeah, I just, in Alaska. You know,
the, for eternity.
That vampires need mommies and daddies was very special.
Yes. Yep. But also like so Nathaniel, I'll put it to you, the sequence where there's the date at the grandfather's house where they're trying to that Max is a vampire. It's very slapsticky. I'll put this to you, Jen. I think that sequence is really funny. I think it was great. It's a little awkward, but like some of the things they do to him, especially like when the lights turn off and they put the mirror in front of his face.
Right.
I thought that was pretty funny. I thought that was a funny sequence.
They're teenagers too. Let's remember this too. They're like, we need to find out if he's a vampire. Yeah. There's no contingency plan of like, if he is, what do we do? Like, they don't even think about the next step.
They're not smart like Stranger Things kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So Jim, what did you think of that sequence of trying to prove that Max was a vampire or not? I don't know how you felt about
it. It was all right. You know, it was getting the plot from point A to point B.
I just like that. If you're going to offer shredded Parmesan cheese, you're going to be like, thank you. Shredded garlic has a distinct, like, large odor.
Yeah, that was gonna say everyone would have known that.
Yeah, everybody would notice. Yeah,
yeah. So, but I love the mirror thing where Max is like, like everybody.
It looked like he was just putting the shavings on there, not even the garlic itself.
Yeah. So, I thought that was funny because it's like, you're right. Like Terry's like, these are kids. They're using kid logic. I thought that was a fun sequence.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. I apologize, but I don't know, man. This film, like, is it perfect? Not at all. Is it a breezy watch? Absolutely.
Oh, that is absolutely true. Yeah.
And is this like something you just put on and be like, you know, we're gonna watch The Lost Boys and have a good time with it?
Yeah.
It's 80s as fuck because you got dirt bikes, because you gotta have dirt bikes, right? Because The Karate Kid showed us you have to have dirt bikes.
Right.
Like the boardwalk is like, it's just something about like that whole thing. I also like that they refer to it as the murder cap of the world, and all, like the biggest thing you see the entire time is just people walking around with their shirt on. Like it's like, oh, this is so unsafe. Like it's like, is this how the conservative media now presents San Francisco? It's like, oh, there's so many unhoused people, and sometimes there's poop on the sidewalks. You're like,
they were actually piggybacking off of real events too by that title. And from 70 to 73, I think it was, there were 28 murders within a 30 month.
But Santa Clara is not a real place. So like, what's the, where are we talking about? Like,
so it's
somewhere there. Yeah.
It's Santa Cruz, I think.
But probably, right? Yeah. So, but yeah, it was one of those things. It's like, man, it seems like the biggest crime here is like just people wanting to have a good meal. And like also probably carnies.
What I found interesting about this, about the town itself, was that we see very few actual adults. It's all, there's like apparently this huge, thriving underground punk, like industrial thing going on in this town. That I'm like, that's the thing that kept, I'm like, is this where are we? Because
a lot of touristy places like that happen. Like, so, like, I'm sorry to cut you off there, man.
No, it's all right.
When I was visiting my mom in a lot of different areas, my mom used to work for Barnum and Bailey Circus. So I've been to Florida, I've been to California, and a lot of these areas, they have transient people that just like, they fall there and they're like, well, I'm just going to continue to live my lifestyle. And you see a lot of these people just kind of still be skaters or whatever they are at that point, you know? So there's a mashing of all these different personalities, and it's really kind of interesting in how they have this homeostasis kind of like idea of like, all right, well, I'm living here and you're living there, and it's like, we're still cool, you know.
No. Well, that is interesting.
Yeah, there's a seasonal thing, right? Like I get that because like I worked at an amusement park here in Ohio, and that was like seasonal. But there's people that would work there during this time of the year, then they would go to Florida to Disney or whatever. Like there's that migrant, like not migrant, that's not the right word, but seasonal transition, right? So like this boardwalk, which I mean that area of California though, it's like that's year round, right? Yeah. So there's a certain amount of that. Like I get that. And also like, I just, you know, I like, there's that brief bit where, a Diane Weiss character was like seeing the people dumpster diving and it's like, just give them some money. Like, cause like, you could tell like as much as I do like her character a great deal, I don't like that. She's like, are we friends? It's like, you're supposed to be their mother, not friends.
But well, she's having a drug conversation with him.
Yeah. Fair enough. And I think probably is the underlying theme of this film is dealing with people that deal with, addiction. I think that's kind of where Michael is more like his like storyline kind of aligns with. It seems like it's an addiction storyline.
No, I could like having an older brother that was a piece of shit that was addicted to shit, like that he would sleep till noon and then like just be like, oh, don't leave me. Like my name's Doug and I'm out of here. Anyway, that's. You know, thank you, Samuel, that you got the reference. I can completely remember those times of like, you don't know what I'm going through, whatever, you know, like I get it. Like, so I can relate to that too. It's just, I know she's trying to find her footing and trying to find, like, be her own person. I get that too.
Yeah.
I just wish that she was given just a smidge more agency in this film.
Yeah. I agree with that too. Cause she reminds me so much of my own mother. That like you get snapshots of your child, you know, like what he's going through or what they are going through at that moment in their lives. And it's like then the moment that you become a little bit present, then all of a sudden it's like, shit, I'm figuring out a lot more than I knew I was like missing, you know, like all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, you know, like because my mom wasn't there for a lot of my childhood. Not saying that, you know, it's the same dynamic, but what Michael is going through all of a sudden. What is it? What's her character name again? It's Diane Weiss. Whatever her like, she's going through with them. Like she's like having like I got to take care of my kids and get a job, and now like Michael, I'm like, what's going on with them?
Like, well, there was that line that like her father said to her is like, you know, you're the only person I've ever known that didn't benefit from a divorce or whatever the line. Right. Which, by the way. Grandpa in this is like the MVP of every movie ever.
And that, I'm going to bring that up at the end of these notes. So like, yeah, please. I just love
how, like Samuel, I think that this is your destiny is to be this guy.
Hopefully. <Yeah.
laughs> Jen, how do you feel about that?
Same ponytail, please.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I'm just hoping that we don't have to have a child to do it.
Right.
No. Like, are you going to have a taxidermy room? Probably. Are you?
I mean, that seems like.
Are you going to break all your TVs and just read the TV guide because that's all you?
That's all you need to know. Yep.
I just
double-stuffed Oreos and root beer for the rest of his life.
For like we talk about all the characters that are underdeveloped. Grandpa's overdeveloped, and I love every moment of it. Like, I want. Like, I know this movie's been like, I just want a grandpa prequel film. Just, I want to learn about him, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
That ending was so dope.
Yes.
I had no expectation that was going to happen. That made me so happy.
Yeah. It also had like the great 80s ending of like, everything's resolved. We're out. Like, love, he got like the best line in the film, right? Like, as we were walking upstairs here to record, we were talking to our wives and like, have fun. I was like, we'll have fun except for all those goddamn vampires. This is what I said on the way up.
Yeah.
I just love that. Like Grant, cause you even see him earlier in the film, like doing like some like work around his compound and putting like posts in the yard and they're steak.
Right. Compound is probably the best description.
Oh
of it
yeah. Like,
because this is like, this place wasn't even a house. Like, so I follow a couple of people on Facebook and everything. So they go back to the filming sites. This was like a polo,
grounds.
Yeah. Okay. Polo grounds or whatever. Oh. It's a place that no one can tear down either. Like it's,
Do you think this was abandoned now?
Is it abandoned? Yeah, it's completely surrounded by barbed wire fence and everything. Okay. So it's a historical place, and no one can touch it. But at the same point, it's like, why don't they do something with it? Like, I mean, look at Franklin Castle out here in Cleveland area.
It's if Ed Gein had an Airbnb, is that the place this would be? Is that
Well, they did Texas Chainsaw Massacre. They take the gas station and they turn it into a barbecue joint. That's a thing now.
Well, I mean, as long as it's not chili, right? I'm kidding. But I'm saying Grandpa here is one of my favorite characters in this film, just because he is so
some shit.
Just idiosyncratic. Whatever. Yeah, I'm not saying that word right because I'm drunk, but also at the end. When you realize that, because he's this is when we talk about the car, where he's that's as close a way to get a town as possible. It's one of those things, it all adds up, right? That he knows what's going on. And he's like, you know what? I'm going to exist. Don't come into my backyard because I will mess you up. I will drive my vehicle with the cucaracha horn and mess stuff up. But then, because he's all these goddamn vampires, it's all these goddamn Dracula.
And is he actually going to the Widow Johnson's place? What's he doing?
No, I'm pretty sure he's getting it on.
Yeah, he's getting it wet.
Maybe.
There's that line that Jason Patrick's said. It's oh, what'd you stuff for her husband or whatever? He's I thought that was a great line. It was an amazing line. And now he's he bristled at it. I thought that was really funny.
I think that grandpa here is this unsung hero that somehow is he Van Helsing? He has all these different stories. Man, I've been keeping the fort down for so long, and then these damn vampires are coming back. The sons of bitches.
It's the prequel we need.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying, dude, that's what I'm saying. And the Frog Brothers have a hint of what's going on, but grandpa knows all of it.
If there was, this is not going to be the right casting because they don't look the same. If there was a prequel story of grandpa that was Nick Offerman, I would watch that.
Oh, yeah, dude.
Holy yes. Snuck. Let's go. Let's go.
The Lost Boy. I don't know what that even means, but anyway, I don't know, man. Also, can we talk about the soundtrack and the support?
Was planning on it. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so the original host of this show, Nathaniel, please.
The original host. You're not keep dominating.
So,
Nathaniel. One second.
Yes.
Sorry, here, how about this? 1 second.
Both of them. Sober, reliable, the best man.
We're taking over the show anyway. So, yeah, please.
Yes, I actually, after finishing the film, I decided I was going to go on Spotify and find the soundtrack, and I listened to it on the way to work and on the way home from work. And it's it's basically the horror equivalent of Rocky IV. Every song is bad, but it's amazing.
How
there are good songs on it. Legitimately good songs. The Doors, People Are Strange. And Walk This Way by Aerosmith are actually legitimately good songs. But
wasn't that People Are Strange by Echo and the Bunnymen?
Yes. Now, there was a cover. Yeah,
it's a great cover too.
But also wait, of the other two, you pick Walk This Way
Little Sister's not a good song, guys. It's amazing. Okay, great. But it's not a good song.
It's amazing, but not a good song.
Yeah. It's so much fun to listen to, but it's a terrible song. I have no idea what those lyrics are supposed to mean. It doesn't actually really follow an actual meter. It doesn't really work, but you are entranced by how fucking bizarre it is. But
I can't wait for your next podcast where you break down songs, and how they're not supposed to be good.
Yeah. But I still like the song. It's just not a good one.
What about I Still Believe by Tim Capello? Come on.
I appreciate
it. That's a cover too, so you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, I don't think it's a particularly good song, but it's a lot of fun to listen to. I really like it. But I'm actually partial in this soundtrack. I was a little bit partial to I had it written down a minute ago here. Lou Graham's Lost in the Shadows.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's during a awesome sequence during the film too.
Yeah, like, it's in the it's motorcycle. Actually in the dirt bike scene. Yeah, the motorcycle race, which is actually is a good scene. But I do like that scene a lot with the way that he makes it completely isolated by filling it with fog, despite the fact the night was clear a few minutes ago. But that's okay. But yeah, I really like that song again because it's absurd. Just listening to it, but I love the part where it's like, you know, welcome to the night, Lost Boys. Like it just starts yelling the title of the movie. I'm not saying Goo Goo Dolls, I'm Awake Now would have been better if they just shouted Freddy's Dead in the middle of it, but I think that may have, I think it might have.
That's a good callback there to it. Yeah. To that film.
To our very first episode, in fact, Deep Cut. But that's still kind of my platonic ideal of what a good theme song should be, is like Goo Goo Dolls, I'm Awake Now. It's a great beginning of Freddy's Dead, and then the movie happens. But in this case, I really do, I like those songs. I think they're a lot of fun, the same way I like the soundtrack to Rad, or Rocky IV. Like these songs are not actually any good. They just are fun to listen to, and they're great. But
Now you're pulling in my love of Rad and Rocky IV and trying to drag this film down, and I will deny you.
I'm not dragging anything down. I listen to those songs all the time.
There's no easy
all the time.
There's no shortcut home. Come on, yeah. Come on.
I listen. Like
paper cutting me to death right now, Nathaniel.
I listen to these songs all the time. I really do. I listen to Break the Ice from Rad, mm-hmm. like a couple times a week. I'm not kidding, but. They're not good songs. They're ridiculous songs.
Demi and Angel should have won the Oscar for the best song ever.
Right. But I mean, it's they are.
I think they have that now.
They are the Lost Boys of the music Different world. Camera. These songs. They are, they're campy. They're weird. They're not, you know.
I will say that, like, when it comes to 80s soundtracks, they get a little ridiculous sometimes. And I have to give it a little bit of levity. A lot of the films that I love are from the 80s, and I have to understand. It's like, yeah, it's silly. And they mentioned the name of the movie within the sound, or, you know,
within the song.
Like, that was the thing that happened.
It's silly, but it's like, it's pretty badass.
I was listening to it. Am I criticizing the songs? I am not.
Tell me which song in the Rocky IV soundtrack literally says Rocky IV.
Well, actually, none of them do. But
right.
But again, you guys are misunderstanding me. I love these songs. I really do. The positive.
We
That's the thing.
You're a monster.
No. Yeah. I enjoy these songs. I listen to them all the time.
I wish there was more, like, I do miss the movie soundtrack tie-in, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's not like just Hans Gruber or whatever the hell.
Hans Gruber.
Hans Zimmerman, Skies,
the Nakatomi Tower Suite, that's by Hans Gruber.
Yes.
Anyway, like, yeah, no, I just think so. Like, what was it? I think the most recent film, in terms of like soundtracks, like the Black Panther, the original Black Panther soundtrack's amazing. The Into the Spider-Verse, amazing. But Psycho Goreman actually made it a point to have a rap track called Psycho Goreman PG for short. That is very right.
I love that.
Rap. I love that so much. So I wish there was more of that sometimes, right? Like,
yeah, that was a 90s thing, having the rap at the end that explained the movie.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, so, Sam's mentioned that many times. It's one of the things he drives him nuts. Yeah.
Yep. Okay, well, yeah. I mean, I agree to disagree. I just think that the music selections here, like, I think they've aged pretty well, because I think we've doubled back to like prog, like synth, like goth, like type of things that are like, I think it's actually aged pretty well. Like there's some soundtracks you're like, oh God, that's of a time, but this is doubled back. And it's like watching this, and Jen, you can speak to this, cause this is the first time watching this. Mm-hmm. Did you feel like the music was like dated?
No, I thought it was a pretty dope soundtrack, except for the Doors. But what can you do?
Right.
Yeah, but
well, it wasn't even the Doors doing it, though.
Yeah, but it was a cover. But it's like also like, okay, we get to California and people.
Jen hates the Doors.
So. I really don't enjoy
it. I don't like the Doors either. So I'm right there with you, girl. Seriously.
There was a book Mike Nelson wrote, and it was in which he talks about the Doors, and he says, "I defy anyone to hear Jim Morrison sing and not have it relate to the sound of their dad singing in the shower." And I'm like, that's it completely, and I'm out.
Listened to his Lizard King shit. Like, no, he's a,
my favorite Jim Morrison quote is Adolf Hitler is alive and well because I slept with her last night. It's like, it's very confusing, but it's like, so wait, what? Did you just sleep with somebody who's like a super anti-Semite? Like, I don't understand it. It's very confusing to me, but I love that he wrote that. It's out in the world.
Yeah, but confusing doesn't mean inspired. Confusing.
Oh, no, you're absolutely right.
Right.
Well, there's also something I remembered a long time ago is like, don't confuse complex for just fucked up. That's the same thing. But like, I think the soundtrack to this is almost like parallel to like Donnie Darko, because Echo the Bunnyman's there too, right? And there's some, it's like, and I'm not saying that they're the same film, they're not, but the soundtracks are both equally wonderful. I think that, you know, so like, I don't know, it's like, this is like crystallized of a place and time. And and Jen, you're talking earlier an hour or so ago about like vampire tropes. Mm-hmm. The thing where it's like, we got to go in during the daytime and find their graves, and that but we find them all hanging upside down because they're goddamn like vampires.
They're bats, yo.
Yeah. And I thought that was great, because like, if people have ever seen that viral video of somebody shooting like a bat sanctuary where they're all hanging upside down with the camera, and it looks like they're like, oh, it's all of us at the goth club.
This forth,
it's like, there we go. Perfect. You know, like, I like that, like, because Jen, you're mentioning how you're like, but they're ignoring XYZ in terms of what we all accept as vampire mythology. Mm-hmm. But also, like, you go forward and you're like, they're not really doing that. Like, they're actually like acknowledging it, but just give the film time. And I think,
especially in the 80s movies, you're not used to letting it wheeled out like that. You're expected, I'm hungry, feed me.
Yes. I also like that, like, one of the Frog Brothers is like, no two vamps go out the same way. So that gave them carte blanche to get gross with all the explosions and all the different, like,
I told Rich, I'm like, I can actually hear the sound or the effect people cursing him.
Yes.
Like, now we have to write a new one for each one of these guys? Seriously?
I think you can tell, like, the first time they stake the dude in, like, the big cave, and it just becomes, like, this, like Evil Dead explosion of gore. That's a lot of fun. And they're all, like, reacting to it. And then later on when we get was it Alex Winter falling? No, it wasn't Alex Winter, because I think he was the one that died in the cave, right? He was the one that died in the cave. But the other guy that fell into the bathtub full of, like, he's like, garlic isn't going to work. It's like, yeah, but holy water. And then Nanook. We got it. Like, come on, dog power. The dog just leaped and hit the guy into the bathtub, and then he just exploded. And then we also get Death by Stereo, the Aerosmith thing that happened. Right. I love that they all
went. Well, that was an NXS song.
Was it? Oh, was it NXS? I'm sorry. All right. Thank you, Terry, for correcting me. But anyway, Death by Stereo, how all of them, and then, you know, Kiefer Sutherland was like, oh, I'm released. And he was like, I'm at peace, so I'm not going to like detonate and cover everybody in gore, which would have been amazing if he would explode the biggest and everybody would have just been covered in blood.
Right. You
know, like, but whatever. Anyway, I love that they're like, oh, no vamp goes out the same way. Do they all agree how they're going to die before that happens?
You sign a little thing when you get turned into a vampire, how you die. Yeah.
You're like, listen, I'm going to drink this blood and then maybe eat some maggots and some
Well, they have to fill out a character sheet when they get turned.
They all roll randomly what's going to happen. Like,
Oh no, the masquerade.
Yeah. Anyway,
I feel like the more I'm the more explodey kind, I don't know. Like, yeah.
Fair enough. Anyway. So sorry, I'm babbling. I apologize. Is this film perfect? Not at all. Are there problems? Absolutely. I understand what Sam was saying about like the fandom. I get that, because I always push back where it's like I have my loves, and I like when people ask me like my top three or four, like three or five films, I know what I have and I will defend them. But I also understand that my three or five films that are my favorites aren't the same as everybody else. When I first moved to Cleveland in 2000, somebody told me one of their favorite films was Jurassic Park 2, and I almost wanted to walk off the porch and fall to my death. I'm like, really? Like, of all, at the time, there was three.
Right.
What's the second one as your favorite?
Amongst all the other films, in general.
What I mean, like, no. Like, I'm saying, like, in terms of dinosaur films run amok, you pick the second one versus...
Lincoln, no, Jurassic 2, yes.
Right. You know, like I was just like, because I was like, you know, like we have some duplexes here where it's like there was like the upstairs apartment. I just wanted to be like, nah, I'm just going to walk and just like flip off and die. It's fine. I'm going to take a header. I'd rather exit this conversation now than to try to engage. I'm just like, oh, that's pretty good. And like, you know, whatever. And then there were so many times that when I was working at Blockbuster, everyone's like, I love the Boondock Saints. So I'd be like, well, you know what? It would be pretty cool if I just slit my throat right now. And yeah,
like, I would agree. I agree. Yeah.
I always want to ask them. Like, I always want to ask them, like, have you seen a second film? Anyway, yeah.
I was going to say the Boondock Saints is a red flag. And not just because it's bad, but because also like it, most of the guys, especially men who like are like, I love Boondock Saints. You know, you're kind of like, are you going to open fire soon? But
I
have a story for you after the mics go off.
Well, Terry opened fire now for watching Boondock Saints.
I don't have any tattoos, but somebody did.
No. Mm-hmm. I just remember like the people coming, like the second one came out and I was like, oh, I really like this film. Like, what else should you recommend? I'm like, I don't know. Garbage. I don't know. But anyway,
Garbage Pail Kids.
No. I'm going to say he's like, if people are championing this film, sure. I mm-hmm. appreciate that because it needs to be, well, I mean, it's a solid film. And here's the thing I've been like sitting on for a couple hours. This is my favorite Joel Schumacher Batman film.
Batman.
Yes.
Bum, 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 bum.
I don't care. I'm going to give you one of these.
Oh, shut up, Paul.
I don't care. I'm saying what I say. It's my favorite Batman's film.
Okay. I see what you were going for there, and yeah. And somebody needs to champion it because right. You know, different tastes or whatever. But
I like the whatever.
But yeah, the
I guess I'm on the whatever side there.
No, I will say I think probably the favorite.
No one ever acknowledges when I press the soundboard on the show. Nobody acknowledges that. Every goddamn time. Anyway, yeah.
Yes. It's funnier that way, Paul. But right. Yeah. But no, I think I think the part of this movie that I did find the most entertaining, it made me like think of a very common riff on Mystery Science Theater 3000. But there's sort of like there's a scene that happens and sort of they smash cut and it comes back to a half naked man with a saxophone gyrating his hips. It's like a smash cut to that. It is one of the most startling things I think I've ever witnessed in cinema. It reminded me every time of whenever they do a quick cut or sometimes in a film, the Mystery Science Theater 3000 guys would go, you know, and I did that unironically where that it just was like snap, bam, there is just something happening and a lot of saxophone noise. And my favorite thing about that entire sequence is how silly all this is, but the people are really into it. Like, this guy has a huge following in this town, apparently. And it just made me laugh.
It's almost like the leader in, like, the Warriors that gets shot during the big sequence, right? It's almost the same
thing. Can you dig it?
Yes.
Yeah. It makes me laugh. This weird, weird half naked man with a saxophone, just going to town and really gyrating some hips.
Yeah,
like so there's a lot of hip work.
Tim Capone is still out there and doing.
Yeah,
it's great.
Yeah,
if anybody knows the band, what was it, Gunship?
Hell yeah, dude.
He's been like, they're a synthwave band. He's been showing up in a lot of their
and
stuff.
He's great at saxophone. He played with Tina Turner. Like
and he's still he's older. He's a Silver Panther, and he still is like built.
He had his own like body oil.
Yeah. And it was like a couple years ago. I know we just did our Steve appreciation episode. I bought a cameo for Steve with Tim Capullo, like shouting out Steve, and he had the saxophone, and he went on for like 2.5 minutes. When I'm like, oh, because most like cameos are like 30 seconds. I'm out. He went on and on and on, like hyping up Steve, and I was like, it was just the greatest goddamn thing in the world. And so
that's pretty awesome. Yeah,
it was really wonderful for Tim Capullo to be like, yeah, you know what, I'm gonna give you more because I'm the sax man. Also, there's the SNL skit that is John Hamm,
right?
Yeah,
gentleman named Circio, right? Sergio, right? Yeah. Look it up, it's wonderful. Anyway, so that's what I'll say about Tim Capullo. He's still out there. If Gunship comes anywhere close to us, Northeast Ohio, we're gonna go. It's gonna be amazing.
At least you and I, Paul, are gonna go.
Yes, and hold hands and make
they have video from him in like the opening sequence of VCR Party.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
I was familiar with the look. Right. And I was not familiar with the execution.
Right.
he is obviously quite a bit older, but like, I mean, he is apparently, from what I understand, he's a great guy, you know.
Also, he was like that one band geek who's like, you know what? Saxophone's gonna pay off eventually. The saxophone waits. Anyway.
Right.
Yes.
No, I think he did an appearance on Joe Bob. Not too long ago.
Yeah, it was the extravaganza thing that he did at, like, somebody else was talking about that too. It was like one of the live appearances.
Yes. He did on that. He was on one of the shows. I think it might have actually been his Valentine's Day show last year, where was like a cutaway joke at the very end where he's like, I got something for all the fans, and it's Tim Capullo rocking with the saxophone.
I will send you all the video like offline. Of him like hyping up Steve, and it was like, it was one of those things, like, I know, sorry, I'm not dragging it back in, but like,
sorry.
It was tickled because I'm like, I paid money for the oiled sax man from the Lost Boys. Right.
Oiled sax man.
So you just got the old one.
Oiled old sax man.
Yeah.
And he was tickled by it, and it was wonderful. So I'll send you guys the link, like, not for the show, but to you guys all. So anyway,
I like that.
Yes, it was wonderful. But anyway, check out Gunship. Amazing band.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. We'll look into it. But yeah, I did love I just loved that. That was probably my favorite part of the entire film, was just the sudden smash cut to that. And I'm like, holy shit, this is coming out of nowhere. Yeah,
check out there's the video they did for Dark All Day. This is the name of the song. That is an animated like thing that's like very vampire-based. Check out that. There's a lot of like completely... There's Lost Boys and other things going on. Like, it's a lot more going on in that video. So everybody should check that out.
So I think that there is like a kind of a crossover from another episode that you guys talked about recently, the movie The Hunger.
Right.
Bauhaus is in that film. I these two films, I think, are like really kind of focused on, in the 80s at least, where they bring on real artists,
mm-hmm. right,
to like kind of represent a moment in the film, but then like it's kind of replicated later on. Like, we see that more often in later films. Another film that you guys discussed was The Crow. My right. Life of the Thrill Kill Cult was in that film, and also Bile is in that film as well. So they're in a different film. Yeah. I'm sorry. Either way, you know, but it becomes a trend in film where it's like, why don't we just kind of like bring in an artist that's already going to be participating on the soundtrack, and right. then we can just like, you know, like do some cross promotion here. That's what happened in this film, you know, like it's kind of cool, you know?
Yeah.
And it's a very, you know, MTV generation kind of thing,
especially with Schumacher.
Right.
Yeah. And I was going to say that, you know, Cry Little Sister, I mean, to this day, if you hear that song, you think of Lost Boys.
Exactly.
Like, it really did connect in that respect. As a theme song, it did exactly what it's supposed to do, which is that anytime now you listen to it, you're going to think of basically Kiefer Sutherland. Because let's face it, that's what people remember about the Lost Boys, I think, more than anything else, is, as Sam Ale put it to me on social media last night, he was never more fuckable than in the movie Lost Boys. And even though I said I was more of a Jason Patrick guy myself, it is still an iconic look, an iconic performance by Kiefer Sutherland, to the point that it's still remembered as easily in his top three.
If this was
to this day,
if any more homoerotic with the tension, it would be Nightmare 2.
Right. Yeah. And it came in number two on a cracked list of the most way back when. Right. Well, no, they, to their credit, they were one of the first people to say out loud that Nightmare 2 was gay. But where they said that was in a five unintentionally gay horror films. I think it was just five unintentionally gay films in general. And number one was Nightmare 2, and number two was The Lost Boys.
Yeah.
Where they were, and they pointed out things like, Terry pointed out, there was a Rob Lowe poster in Corey Haim's room, Born to Shop. His clothing is all coded homosexually, in a homosexual manner, rather. And then there is the sexual tension between Kiefer and Jason Patrick, although it's more one-sided, I think. I feel like Patrick's kind of clueless about it.
Yeah, he's kind of
And is not giving that energy back, but Kiefer's like, I'm gonna fuck that guy.
Well, he has from the entire film.
Yeah.
But that's what I mean kind of when I said that Jamie Gertz in some way seems like it's meant to be the beard, because they pay lip service to the fact that Patrick talking to her is what causes Kiefer to pick on him. Right. And then his response to the picking on is what makes him want to make him one of them. But ultimately, she says in that big climactic scene where, you know, she's like, he only did it because you paid attention to me, and then I didn't kill you. So now he's making it harder on me. Like, this is actually about me. And we're like, honey, no, it's not. nothing is about you, Star, unfortunately. This is about these two guys. And that's, again, I think it's a flaw in the film, that Star is said to be important, but you don't feel like she's actually important. She has very little to do. They even give her a kid just to give her something to do.
Right.
You know, it's like,
by the way, when he starts vamping out, the Frog Brothers freak out. They don't know how to handle the small kid.
And he's the best looking vampire in the film too, by the way.
After they douse that guy in like the tub, they're like, okay, but like Nanook was the main factor in that. So yeah, right. Like it was one of those things, like they even say later on, it's like, oh, we killed that one guy, but Nanook helped a little bit. Like they
acknowledged. Yeah.
Also, if you go back and watch that sequence, somebody threw that that husky at that actor. They just threw it out.
Like, yeah, threw him a couple of times, in fact. But yeah, that husky got thrown around a lot. But yeah, I mean, like it just is. It's interesting that that homoerotic tension is there, because obviously Schumacher himself was homosexual at the time, openly gay at the time, and he he was obviously, that was bringing that sensibility to it. But I think part of what bothers me about Star's sort of presence is that it gets in the way of that. That I think that should have been more focused on. But I feel like Lost Boys kind of maybe had to crawl so Interview with the Vampire could walk. Like, you know, so I'll give it credit for that. Like, it's trying to talk about something that maybe they weren't allowed to talk about in 87.
Anne Rice actually explored a lot more sexuality, because like, you're immortal and your private parts don't work so good anymore. So how are you going to do that? Like I read the book. I don't think you guys had a discussion, like, but it's like,
yeah,
I think there was a lot more exploration of like, what do you do when you live forever? Like, how? I guess all vampires should be pansexual, if that's what we're going to get to.
Yeah. It would make sense. Yeah, over a long enough timeline. Yeah, I mean, eventually growth and change to the point of you'd need something else to do. That's usually that's why, like, most philosophical conversations about how all of that is a construct anyway is generally coming from, actually, if you think about it, there's no reason not to be.
Yeah.
You know, actually, it's sort of like, why would you not, you know, at this stage in human evolution, we don't necessarily need it anymore. The film, I think, deserves the credit for at least trying to kind of go take some baby steps in that direction. Mm-hmm. But even though it does make for a slightly more flawed film, I think because we have an extraneous character kind of wandering around, being the girl, because there has to be a girl,
in the movie in 1987. Just a straight up like monster film of vampires and whatever.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know. This film's a lot of fun. And I think it's actually like professionally like shot and well done. And it's easy to watch, easy to like, you know, digest. And I think Joel Schumacher understood the assignment. I will say that. And I'm not saying all the time, because his filmography is very wobbly. I know I was one with you guys talk about, was it 8mm? Like, which I adore that film. Like, well, sorry. It's a very hard film to watch, but I think that as a filmmaker, I think he kind of embraced the gun for hire. Like, I'm going to just do this versus like, I'm above this.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, you get your Nolans or whatever, where it's like, I can't do that. Like, Schumacher never turned down a role to do, never turned down a job to do something.
Yeah.
That means that he's had way more misses than hits, but he took the paycheck. That being said, he still brought a guided sense of professionalism and had everybody involved to do the best they could.
Yeah.
And I think this film's solid. I think it's a solid film for what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for what it is.
Yeah.
I would definitely say that. I mean, like I said, I think it's a little flawed, but I don't hate it. You know, I'm not like, you know, watching it as a chore. Right. But it, you know, because as you also said, it is an unbelievably breezy movie. Like you can just kind of just chill for an hour and a half and watch this film. It's not asking you to do a lot of work.
Can we at least appreciate films that are not like 2 hours plus at this point? Can we appreciate films that are in and out? Like, because like the short attention spans of the year, I get it, but it's also like second, third, fourth, fifth passes at scripts.
Yeah.
Can we at least appreciate where we're at? Mm-hmm. This film was in and out, and like it didn't, I'm not saying there's no fat trim, but like it isn't like an overstayed its welcome, which is very much appreciated in this day and age.
Before anybody else says, thank you, Paul, for shutting up. The last thing I will say really quick, especially leaning towards what Nathaniel was talking about. You guys just recently talked about Interview with the Vampire.
Mm-hmm.
That was like one of the original script writers for this film read that Anne Rice book, and they were like, how can we combine this with the idea of Peter Pan?
Right.
I think that's really interesting, because you can go different ways with it. And that was like the early stages of this script. So, I find that interesting that your more recent discussion was Interview with the Vampire. So.
Totally.
So it all comes full circle.
Sam, did you have anything you wanted to add, or?
No, I don't have anything else for this. It's just a lot of fun. It's
okay.
It's a good movie. I'm glad Jen liked it.
It's okay for movies to be fun.
Yep.
It's okay.
No, I agree.
It don't have to be amazing.
Yeah, no, it's a fun. It is what it is. Like, it is the most. It's one of the most '80s films in terms of genre, right? Like.
Oh yes, yeah, it is absolutely that, yeah, and it is kind of glorious, yeah. I mean, it's glorious, and I think the same way Rocky IV is glorious, or Rad is glorious,
right?
You know, right. It's
so glorious.
Yeah, they're wonderful movies, but they're not necessarily good ones, but they are a time capsule of a certain time and place. A certain set of cultural or social tropes,
right?
That really do represent the time and how silly it kind of is. So, but yeah, do we have anything we want to add before I wrap up?
No, I think we've covered just about everything, unless Paul has something else.
Okay.
That wasn't meant to sound accusatory.
Thank you. Like, I understand that you did not, like, we talked about it and then you added the schedule. It was wonderful to revisit. It's been a few years, and I enjoyed this film, and thank you all for the discussion. I appreciate it.
And you got something you want to plug, or?
Yeah, why don't you tell us about, I mean, everybody's surging on this, but yeah, if you want to talk about Strange Highways.
Yeah, so Terry and I, who's indisposed at the moment because he had to go to the little vampire's room. So he was drinking all that red wine. I don't know. Red wine. Why wasn't UB40 involved in this soundtrack? Now, Terry and I do a show called Strange Highways, where we've been, it's an anthology-based podcast, where we mainly focus on the Twilight Zone. The original series was covered, and we're now about to finish up. We're three episodes away from finishing season two of the 80s iteration, which is funny because CBS, again, they were meddling in the original series. And then somehow they were meddling in the 80s iteration. So it feels like CBS was like, oh, we like this. Oh, but you could do better. It gets weird.
Right.
So anyway, so we're about to round out season two. We have three episodes to go. I'm hitting microphones. And then spoilers, season three was produced solely in a Canadian market just for syndication.
Right.
That was never for air. That was never for broadcast in America. So it's going to get a little weird. We have no idea what's coming. So I will argue that the original Twilight Zone has its ups and downs. It is, when people are like, oh, we're a fan of the show, I'm like, have you seen more than five episodes?
All right.
Twilight Zone. So like, yeah. So I feel so bad that I drug Terry through this. Because the 80s iteration, he's back from the little vampire's room. It's fine.
Too much blood. too much blood in your alcohol.
Too much maggots and worms. We just recently covered an episode called Time and Teresa Golowitz or whatever. Yeah. One of the worst goddamn things I've ever watched in my life.
Fell on the other side of that. I thought it was okay. So that's kind of how we construct our podcast.
Yeah. Right. And we're about to finish the second season of these iterations. People go check it out. It's a lot of fun. It's 40 miles of bad road. At that point, and I hope to have you guys on
with our bits of detour. So, like, we're still trying to find stuff.
Once we finish the second season, hopefully, you guys will come on and talk about some weird shit. So,
yeah, that'd be great. Some guests. Mm.
We'll see. Here. How about one of these? Let's see here. What do I have here? What do I have?
What's the soundboard say?
Yeah. What? Here it is. There you go. So there we go.
gets a little ridiculous.
Some random screaming. That's most of what about this?
Just go home. Just a sex fiend.
You know,
there you go, without context.
That was actually from the last podcast. Yeah. So
so that's cool. Here.
And thank you guys both. I know that I'm the head vampire for Samael.
Right,
as the podcasting bug. So,
well, we're about to shake you in the heart. So,
thanks to Jen too for being like the outsider coming in and like.
Yeah, no, but I'm saying if you guys kill me,
it's cool.
Both of our
thank you, Terry, for inviting her.
Yeah,
no, I'm saying
I think that's badass. Though I like when there's like somebody who's coming in completely cold, not understanding. Like,
that was a good idea. Yeah,
I think that's great. Was like all the dynamics are like here presented tonight.
Yeah, and I'm an asshole like he's pressing buttons. So yeah, please check out Strange.
Thanks for showing up, Paul.
Yeah, thank you for being in my house right now. I also spoilers. I made dinner for Terry and his wife, and I added so much garlic that it's going to kill a vampire. So you guys know that.
Unless we're
Terry will be satisfied.
Yeah. Yes, but I made that gif of Corey Haim just smashing garlic. That
right.
All the garlic he was smashing is not enough for my wife. I understand that.
My wife too.
Yeah. So anyway, but yeah, thank you guys for having us on. Thank you for two episodes ago for indulging me when talking about like our loss of our friend. I'm not trying to like go back to that, but it was thank you. And
if always anybody, glad to be here, you know.
And if anybody wants to meet Steve and find him, Invasion the podcast, the show's over, but I have like 200 episodes of him and you guys were for that too. Go find it.
Yep.
He's a wonderful person. So anyway, sorry, not trying to drag
nope,
it down.
That's yeah, okay.
And yeah, just yeah, anyway. So yeah. Here we go. Sorry, it's late.
Okay. Well, with that, I will say again, thank you. Thanks, Paul and Terry, for coming on.
Thank you, sir. And
thanks, Jen, for coming on as well. It's always nice to see you. You're always welcome.
Likewise.
Yeah. I will say thank you very much for listening. We remind you to keep it positive, keep it constructive, love yourself, love your fellow horror fans, and be nice to each other. And with that, I'll say thank you very much. Good night. And... Namaste. Oh, dancing at the devil's door.